Welcome to EIR Talks. On August 18th and 19th, members of Lyndon LaRouche's political movement from Europe, Asia, Africa, and the Americas met in Oberwesel, Germany, for a conference on political strategy under a banner reading, "The Battle for the Mind. What is the prospect facing young people today?" This week, EIR Talks brings you excerpts from the keynote address by Lyndon LaRouche, which was entitled, "Rally the Citizens Behind a Mission for All Mankind." Here's Lyndon LaRouche.
My problem today is I know exactly what the situation is in terms of the nature of the crisis. I also know what the remedies are, at least in terms of types of remedies. The problem is, how do you make the connection to the politicians who, in general, do not know? The political class today in the United States and in Western Europe in particular, or in South and Central America, is of a much poorer class than existed in the 1970s or early 1980s. As a matter of fact, our politicians as a class of people are generally political illiterates by the standards of politicians of the same rank 20 years ago. Therefore, people today do not know history. The educational systems of the past 30 years and longer have been destroyed. Classical humanist education, which is the only competent education, has been ripped out of the curriculum. Teachers who are qualified to teach in a classical humanist classroom generally no longer exist. They have long since retired and many are deceased. The teachers available in teaching today are not qualified. The politicians are not qualified. The population is not qualified to vote. In terms of understanding what the things are, the consequences for them and the future of humanity of what they vote for. They don't know. Many of them don't care. They are taught to plead for some special thing that bothers them and to ignore the rest. In the United States, this phrase is used and has been used since the draft dodges of the 1960s. I don't go there. You bring up a subject. I don't go there. Don't bother talking to me about that. I won't do anything about that. Well, what if it hurts you? It won't hurt me. I don't go there. There will be no depression. I don't go there. I don't discuss depression. It doesn't affect me. I don't go there. So that's our problem. So those of us who have some understanding literacy have a problem. The politicians don't have the sense presently to know what to do. And what has to be done is rather urgent. The survival of civilization depends upon it. The populations we have to lead don't understand their own problem. They don't know what solutions are. And I'll indicate one of these very specific problem of the population in general. So therefore, what is needed is to take people who are capable of understanding, which is a very rare part of the population, academic and political and so forth, very rarely. For example, you probably have a couple of people in Germany who are capable of understanding what I talk about, really understanding it. You probably have fewer in France, and they're probably much older than I am. That they're older people who've long since retired who still remember how history used to work, at least in their time. In the United States, the entire young generation, people born after 1945, in general, with almost no exception, are not only intellectually incapable of understanding the issues that face the world today, the United States in particular, they're not even capable of understanding their own issues. They had a program back in the 1950s, a television program called Romper Room. And this was a program designed for children, but actually designed for the parents who were rendered infantile by the way children were being raised at that time. In other words, if you want to qualify as a parent, you have to get down to your child's level. And many of them went succeeded in reaching that level and even lower. And the television program which featured this kind of entertainment in the morning or early afternoon for parents and their children, age 5 and under or something like that, was called Romper Room. Now, there are people, and even some of my associates in the United States, who emotionally, when put under stress, raise the elevation of their speech. They go into the fourth register. And squeak and say very simple and very stupid things. And you think, Romper Room has returned. Even in my own association in the United States, I hear conversations, reports, discussions, even among leading members of my association in the United States, which take me back to Romper Room. And what has happened is Romper Room lives inside them and under stress tends to come out and reenact itself. Now, you find similar things in Germany and Italy and so forth. I've seen evidences of this. So the problem is you have a population which, by all usual standards of the early 20th century, let alone earlier, is not qualified to arrange for its own survival under the kinds of problems which are facing the world today. Therefore, our job, those of us who do understand, who do know what the solutions and the problems are, our job is, first of all, is to present the general nature of the problem and the solution to a very limited number of people, including perhaps the dozen people in Germany who can understand what I'm saying. That is in terms of these problems. We, among these small groups, as I presented this to a group of accountants that I addressed in Mexico City by satellite communication recently. We had 3 hours of various things and went through this. We have to bring together, first of all, the people who are capable of immediately discussing intelligently the kind of problems, the kind of solutions that I know exist. But that's not enough. I know what the general possibilities are. I know what the problems are in general. But then we have to implement these solutions. For example, take a concrete case. The best estimate right now is that next week Argentina will go under. That's the best estimate. May go on longer, but that's where it stands. Now, what happens when Argentina goes under? And that will start a chain reaction. Turkey will go next. Poland is ready to go. Poland is in worse condition than Argentina in some respects, financially, because of the mismanagement of the people who've taken the place over under advice from people in the post-Soviet period. What do we do? I know what the solution is. But how do I, tomorrow morning or the week after, how do I actually proceed in the case of Argentina as such, to solve the problem of Argentina without making a mess of everything else I've got to do in Brazil or in Western Europe and so forth? How do I deal with that? That means I've got to talk to people who are capable of defining a policy of action to say the United States government and other governments will make the following measures available to Argentina now to guarantee the continuity of the functioning of that nation, which means that whatever else happens, the pensions will be paid, employment will continue, essential functions of government and production will continue, trade will continue, and will grow. Because the only way you get out of depression is not with fiscal austerity. You never cut employment as a way of dealing with the depression. You never cut production as a way of dealing with the depression. You never cut government expenditures as a way of dealing with the depression. That's how Hitler came to power in Germany, when people made the foolish move of cutting things and cutting things instead of maintaining government instead of maintaining employment, instead of maintaining security, instead of maintaining trade and so forth. So we have to keep Argentina alive. And we must make the decisions, the management decisions, practical, immediate, emergency decisions, which keep Argentina alive. Now, that means we have to come to some agreement on these measures. We have to actually discuss and say, what is a tolerable solution and what is an intolerable one? We have to consider not only Argentina today and next week and next month, but we have to think about what's going to happen to Brazil, to Chile, to Poland, to Turkey. All of these economies are collapsing. We also have to think about the fact that there's not a single economy in Western Europe which is not really bankrupt. That is, every economy in Western Europe is producing less than is required to maintain what it was yesterday afternoon. We're eating more than we're producing in terms of overall necessary inputs. That's what you see reflected in the government, with Eichel, for example, here in Germany. Cut, 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 cut. Fiscal austerity, cut, 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 cut. Every time they cut, they make the problem worse. Now, there's certain things that could be cut out without damage to the economy, like not paying certain politicians or something like that. That would be helpful. But in general, as this Wilhelm Lautenbach laid out his policy in the now famous meeting of the Friedrich List Gesellschaft in 1931, cutting, cut, cut, cut is the mark of the lunatic beast under conditions of depression. To cut, cut, cut now in Western Europe is a piece of lunacy. What we have to do is increase production and increase employment, and thus bring things above the so-called break-even point in terms of level of output. That means we must have the markets for find the markets for Europe so that Germany can go back to being an export leveraged nation. Markets for France, markets for Italy, for example, markets for the so-called Scandinavian region. We must develop those new markets or expanded markets abroad for the things which Western Europe produces best, the quality of goods which are most needed in these markets, which are largely developing sector markets and are largely in East, South, and Central Asia, especially East and South Asia. These are the great markets. These are the great population centers. This is where the great development is going to occur. Where the Three Gorges Dam in China is an example. There's a proposal for a large dam on the Brahmaputra River in Tibet. It's one of the great rivers of the world. It has the greatest hydroelectric potential of any project available for construction now. It would transform the entire region of China, of that part of northeastern India. And would also enhance flood control for not only India, but also Bangladesh, which has a big flood problem, largely defined by the Brahmaputra flows. So these markets exist, and therefore we would say we must retool the economies, get rid of the fluff, but maintain pensions, rebuild the healthcare system, rebuild the educational system, build infrastructure. That's the easiest place to start expanding employment, because there's always needed infrastructure, urban infrastructure, general infrastructure, reforestation, healthcare systems, so forth. Always needed. Never a waste of money. And which contribute to the productive powers of labor, not only per capita, but for the population as a whole. It would be not too difficult, with what I know, to bring all of Western Europe quickly into a state, from this present state of poverty, of sliding into a bottomless pit of cut, 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 into a period of resumed long-term growth with a 25-year assurance of long-term growth that we could do. Therefore, we need minds of people who say, that is the mission. The world is greatly mismanaged. The economies are incompetently managed. The governments have been incompetent, and now we're going to change it. We're going to restore competence for a 25-year perspective for expanding, developing the world, so we will leave the next generation in far better condition than the one we have now. That's our mission. And therefore, we'll sit on the case of Argentina and every other case, and we will make those decisions. And we will debate, are we going to do this, are we going to do that? And what we will settle upon is what we can live with. And what we can live with is what the next generation can live with. The whole world's next generation can live with. So then we will say, we therefore agree. We didn't have detailed agreement all the way through at the start of the conversation. We faced the problem. We had debates among contending groups of experts. We talked it out again and again. We said, what can we live with? What can they live with? What can the next generation live with? We've got to do it tomorrow. We're going to do it. Now, what do we do next? At that point, we have to be prepared to go into the politicians and say, dear friendly idiot, here is what you guys have got to do. And if you don't do it, here's what's going to happen to you. Now, naturally, screaming and yelling will emerge. Banshee shrieks. People will change their sex right before your eyes. But that you've got to respond to it. You've got to box them in. You're dealing with people who say, I don't go there. There is no truth. It's only a matter of opinion. This is the kind of idiocy you're going to face. Well, whatever your opinion is, buddy, you either do this or this country's dead. So you better change your opinion. That's the way, and you have to present them the hard facts. Box them in. No matter how much they scream and yell, box them in. You want to govern this nation? You want to decide how to govern this nation and its relation with other states? Then get with the game or get out of it. Because if you don't go for this, we're going to denounce you publicly for what the effects will be of not doing what you have to do. The games are over. Your pet projects are over. We're now at a point where the human race has to decide to survive. And you, buddy, learn the lesson now. Just assume you don't know anything, and you're learning as of today. You have to complete the lesson before the end of the day, because you're going to have to go in and vote for it. You're going to have to make the legislation. You're going to have to tell the professional bureaucracy what to do, and they're going to do it. You're going to go to the bankers and tell them to straighten out. We don't want any banker who disagrees with Herrhausen. Just go back to Herrhausen. That's the last banker in Germany that understood anything. Start from there. What he recommended for Eastern Europe before he was assassinated. That's where you start from. So therefore, we have to start first with the circles of people who are capable of understanding these and discussing these matters and deliberating on them in a responsible way. But these groups of people do not have the authority to make the changes. They have the moral authority to lead, but they don't have the authority to make the changes. The authority lies with governments and other important institutions of society. So therefore, the experts have to immediately educate the decision makers. And the best of the decision makers and the experts together have to rally the institutions of the populations to support these things. It's very much like conducting a war. That people understand, there used to be wars, you know. There could be again. In war, how do you get a people to fight a war? Well, first of all, you take them back about 50 years or so, when they still could do that. Now they would say, I don't go there. I'm a soldier, but I don't go to the Balkans. Or you can imagine a German soldier these days on the German budget to say, you have to go to the Balkans. You're our German force in the force in the Balkans. But you don't have any uniform. You don't have any money. Just get down there. The guy has to go in as a nudist. He infiltrates it. He infiltrates an Albanian nudist camp and steals some clothes and weapons and then deploys. But that's not the way. That's what not the way that wars were fought and won in the past. Wars were fought, first of all, because a people who didn't like to die believed that it was necessary for them to put themselves at risk in order to save the nation and to save the conditions of their nation and humanity for the next generation and that beyond. And therefore they would willingly, with fear, with trepidation, with great reluctance, but would willingly do what they thought was necessary for them to do. Now the same thing is true, the moral equivalent of going to war, is we face now. We have to take this population, just the same way that people were drafted in 1940-41 in the United States, out of all kinds of conditions, and we say, we're going to war. We're going to war against chaos. We're going to war against depression. We're going to war against misery and stupidity. Because if we don't win this war, there's not going to be a next generation, at least not one in fit condition to live. And therefore, we have to put ourselves on the line for the coming generation. And we have to find in ourselves to do that, to fight that kind of fight, either a war or the kind of fight we have now to make, under very difficult conditions of world depression, which is really here. We have to mobilize in people a sense which is a much higher sense of personal morality than exists in populations today. Now, I mean by this my personal morality problem. People who lack personal morality are people who live, talk about, we seem to have people who talk about my interests, my family interests, my personal interests, my career, my community, my particular trade union, my industry, my city, mine. They think about it in terms of the next few years at most. If they're a banker, they think of the next few minutes. They don't think about the future. The gratification in the here and now is everything. Pleasure and pain in the here and now. Protecting one's illusions in the here and now. I don't want to know what's going to happen next year. I want to feel good now. The entertainment society. It's not a work society anymore, it's an entertainment society. So in order to get a population mobilized to defend itself, you have to evoke in them a sense of that there's something more important about their life than their personal experience in the next few minutes, or their immediate surroundings, or their immediate prejudices or tastes or preferences. They have to think of themselves as a part of humanity. They have to think of themselves as sharing the gifts of ideas, of knowledge, of culture, which have been transmitted to them over previous generations, which the persons now deceased have given to them, the great scientific discoverers of centuries earlier, all the great artists of centuries earlier, have given to us, now that they are deceased, they have given to us, through transmission to us, of the great gifts of culture on which our power as a society depends, per capita, as an individual and as a society. We are going to die, all of us. We don't take it with us, not our mortal selves. What we take with us is what we give to humanity that comes after us. It's the meaning of our life. What do we give to humanity? What is our sense of saying we have lived without blushing in shame, without saying my life was nothing, all of this was just my pleasure? All of this was my pleasure seeking, my personal gratification from moment to moment. What does my life mean? I'm about to die. What does it mean? What did the whole life mean? Well, is it the time to start thinking about that is long before you die? First of all, the first objective is to acquire as much as you can of the gifts of humanity to you, especially in terms of ideas, culture, opportunity. The second thing is to develop yourself as much as possible to make a similar contribution, at least in the transmission of that culture to future generations. And that's the least you do. When you say, I'm that kind of person, then you have made the transition from being merely a mass of people to becoming a true citizen of a true republic. As a citizen, you live for the society for all time. You bring new meaning and added benefits of outcome of the lives of those who've gone before you. You take their gifts. You build upon what their sacrifice, upon their contributions, and you change the outcome of what they gave you by making it successful, huh? More successful. You add something to that. You give it to those who come after you, and you are happy because you sense that you have lives inside you, like the figures in, I've often referred to in this School of Athens, of Raphael, the mural, which is in the Vatican Library today. All these people, they all live in a different time. They're not contemporaries. Some of them are, some not. They're different people. They all represent, from the standpoint of the classics, they represent ideas. Each person represents a contention about an idea. Each of these, the works of each of these, as a painter or a philosopher, can be reenacted in modern times. Each of those figures you see portrayed by Raphael in the School of Athens was a living person whose work is known, whose discoveries and arguments you can re-experience in yourself. You know the name, you have a picture, you know the circumstances, if you have decent education. They live inside you. They live inside your memory, not as pictures, not as images. They live as the process of generating ideas. It's their ideas that live in you. The struggle among ideas among them lives within you. That is what you have inside you, in your memory. All these great contributions, they're living there like people, like your conscience inside you. You don't obey them, but you respect them. And you don't do anything shameful in front of them, in your own memory. That's conscience.
You're listening to EIR Talks. We'll return in a moment with more of Lyndon LaRouche's speech from Oberwesel, Germany. To replay this program or to read the full transcript of the conference, visit our website at larouchepub.com. Welcome back to EIR Talks. We'll continue now with more of Lyndon LaRouche speaking on August 18th in Oberwesel, Germany.
You look to the future, and you imagine the faces of those who are going to come after you. And you think what the future must think of you. And what are you going to give to the future? Are you going to create a future that will enhance the outcome of your having lived? Can you make a contribution and ensure that future generations will take your contribution and build upon it to do something better than you've ever achieved? I mean, these were the people used to have these ideas. You know, people, for example, immigrants in the United States would come from, for example, from Europe. They'd go into the United States. The first generation would struggle greatly. It was difficult. It was painful. They'd sacrifice. They'd raise a family. And their objective was that family would have a better chance than they had. And they would think about their grandchildren, the next generation after that. That generation would be professional, would be skilled, would be a solid citizen of the country they were living in, would make an important contribution. And in a simple way, these people who came to the United States as immigrants would think like that. They'd work like that. They'd live like that. They say that something better is going to come out of my having lived and what I'm doing now. I don't know what it will be, but I know it will be good. And I'll see it coming into being. And that's what we have to mobilize in the population. You start from, as I said, you start from the crisis. You go from the crisis, as discussed among the experts you bring together, who are willing to face the problem of the decision, as the case of Argentina now confronts us. Or the case of Poland, really. The case of Turkey, same thing. Then you have to win over the institutions which must make these decisions to suddenly become sensible when these institutions right now are not very sane. Just look at any parliamentary procedure. Look at Jospin in France. It's a tragedy. Then you look, you say, well, that's a terrible tragedy to have such a prime minister. Then you look at the president. Oh, my God, another tragedy. Then you look at most of the ruling class there. It's the same thing. You look at almost any country. You look at most of the parliament. You look at the politicians. You look at the publications, the leading newspapers, the television. Look how people spend their time with their entertainment, their reading, their discussion, their behavior. It's frightening. This is decadence in the extreme. So we have this decadence. We have the decadence among the politicians. They have to be frightened into suddenly becoming sane and guided, held by the hand. A strict teacher is going to have to teach them. We're going to have to mobilize the population and its institutions at the same time. But we're going to have to, as an end result, give a sense of mission to that that population and to those institutions. A sense of mission of what we're going to accomplish, what the end result will be, what the next generation's judgment will be of what we've done for them on a planetary basis and in each nation. Without that sense of mission, all the other things will tend to fall. And we've got to do that. We have to do that. Otherwise, look, ma, no world. We have a terrible problem. Now, let me just indicate how we got here. We take it in two steps. We take the first step is the general period since 1945. As the end of the war approached, Roosevelt was committed to eliminating all vestiges of colonialism from this planet and eradicating free trade. This he said to Churchill in 1942 and otherwise. He said, Winston? And Winston was glowering. And at Casablanca, Winston brought along this guy, Louis Mountbatten, Lord Louis. And Roosevelt came in the room, and there's Winston and Mountbatten standing there. And he said, Winston, I know why you brought that bastard. Roosevelt was a very insightful fellow. And he said, we're not going to do it anymore, Winston. And when the war ends, we're going to take down the Portuguese, the Dutch, the English, and the French colonial systems and their vestiges. We're going to give these people who you brutalized a chance to have their own countries and a chance to develop their own countries, including, and so I'll show you, Winston, what we're going to do in Africa. And he put out these charts showing the large-scale infrastructure projects intended for Africa. And Roosevelt, it wasn't Keynes, it was Roosevelt, designed the post-war Bretton Woods system in its first form at Bretton Woods. Then Roosevelt died before the end of the war. And the successors of Roosevelt couldn't wait until his body was cold to tear up many of the things he decided to do. Among it, you notice immediately that British, Dutch, and other troops, including Japanese troops, were sent in to recolonize the areas which Roosevelt had prescribed would be freed. And they did it in a bloody way. The Dutch and the British with U.S. backing in Indonesia, and so forth and so on. But despite that, and then they also, in order to prevent Europe from being organized, or Eurasia from being organized, the British and their friends organized what became known as the Cold War. To divide Eurasia against itself as a geopolitical strategy for controlling Eurasia. You see, people in Eurasia do not conduct wars against each other. People in Eurasia are treated like puppets on strings. And the puppet master, the Anglo-American puppet master, pulls the strings and has the various people of the various nations make war against each other. And then, as Henry Kissinger expresses it, they come in with conflict management, which is what the Roman Empire did, the way it controlled the subject peoples. It's the way the empires of Mesopotamia, in their time, controlled subject peoples. How does a small oligarchy control a large mass of people? You divide the people among themselves, put them at each other's throat, and then come in as a manager, as an arbiter between them. You play one against the other. Is what they're doing in the Middle East now with this crazy thing from Israel. This is not a Palestinian-Arab Israeli conflict. This is a puppet conflict orchestrated by Anglo-American interests who, for geopolitical reasons stated by Brzezinski, are determined to have a clash of civilizations war throughout the southern strip of Eurasia in order to break up Eurasia, to destroy it, so they can manage the world for their globalized system. That's why nobody can stop the war unless we do it the way we're trying to do it now. It can't be stopped. And it will not be a war. It'll be a religious war, which is what they intend it should be. Why should any idiot want to send a mob of Protestant fundamentalists from the United States up to take the Dome of the Rock and ravish it and establish a temple on the Dome of the Rock? Starting religious warfare. Why? Because they want to start religious warfare. If you take all the divisions of Islam and all the other religious issues of the southern strip of Asia and Central Asia, you start an attack on Islam of that type, a travesty of that type, you will set into motion a chain reaction of bloodletting. Worse than what happened in Europe in the period 1618 to 1648 with the Thirty Years' War, which was intentional. The Thirty Years' War was not something between Protestants and Catholics in Germany. It was something orchestrated by Venice in an operation which had initially been planned by Paolo Sarpi, which had been delayed for a while. It was a pattern of religious war in Europe which from 1511 to 1648, which almost destroyed Europe, which created in Europe. The Europe of the Renaissance was devastated in the main by religious war directed by Venice, which began in 1511 under Venetian direction and continued to 1648. And we got out of it with the Treaty of Westphalia. Now, we should have learned the lesson and never again allow religious war to arise on this planet. Because the consequence is to plunge the planet into a virtual dark age, plunge humanity backwards. Anyway, so that's what the problems are. So that was what happened to us. But under those conditions, we had from 1945 to about 1963, 1964, in the relations among the United States, the Americas generally, Western Europe, Japan, there was a general improvement in the average conditions of life of the people, a general improvement in the economy, general growth, rebuilding, post-war rebuilding, and so forth. Similarly, at the same time, in the Soviet Union, there was a significant amount of reconstruction, which continued also in the same period, into about the middle of the 1960s, under Soviet system, in a different way. So that overall, you say, if you go back to the period from 1945 to 1963-64, there was a general period of net progress under terrible conditions, admittedly, but in these parts of the world. In the middle of the 1960s, a change occurred. Since, if you take the entire period from about 1966-67 to the present time has been in a period generally of an accelerating rate of decline of the conditions of life worldwide. In the United States, in the Americas, in Western Europe, and in the former Soviet Union and Comic-Con. The actual physical conditions of life, life expectancy, health care, nutrition, so forth, all of these conditions of life are worsened. Poland is in a worse state today by far than it was in 1989. You had an initial government of Poland in that period, the Solidarność leadership, which wanted to reconstruct Poland immediately, very sensible objectives. But then the pressure came in from the Anglo-Americans, and Poland was stripped down. The Mont Pelerin Society came in with its ideas, the Thatcherite ideas, stripped it down. East Germany, yes, the parts of East Germany were, in after the wall came down, certain things were improvements. But the agro-industrial potential of the area of East Germany was ruined. Much of the infrastructure that was built up in the post-wall period was actually infrastructure was built up on credit system, which created a mountain, turned a mountain of debt into an enlarged mountain of debt for speculators. The kind of debt speculation which you see, for example, in Germany today, in Berlin, in the collapse of the Berlin Bankgesellschaft, which is a result of private speculators looting the government indirectly and the people through real estate speculation and living on it. Whole party functionaries getting into power through the money, through this kind of graft. And this is the situation throughout Europe. The situation of the Soviet Union, the former Soviet Union, same thing. Looted. I'll take South and Central America. Look below the borders. Go back to 1988. Beginning of 1989. Look at the map of Central and South America. How many of the nations designated then on this map were then independent functioning nations? That is, with governments which actually had some authority, with institutions which were stable, and with some of the capabilities for economic growth. Well, what happened to Central America? Central America was destroyed. What happened in Colombia? Well, Colombia is essentially destroyed. Venezuela is about to be destroyed. Ecuador doesn't really exist anymore. Its sovereignty was dollarized out of existence. Peru is just crushed by a coup imposed from the United States. A real fascist style of coup. Argentina is being destroyed. Chile is being destroyed. Bolivia, Paraguay, Uruguay. Brazil is largely carved up and threatened with destruction. This whole area that used to be an area of proud nation states, admittedly afflictions, but proud nation states, they don't exist anymore. Or they are hanging by their nails on the edge of a cliff. Look at Africa. Africa was in terrible condition. But what's the condition now? Genocide beyond belief. And it's raging on. Predators like the older George Bush with Barrick Gold in Congo. Mass murder with private armies to loot the raw materials of the region. Look what's happened in Europe, Western Europe. Economies that were once strong. Take the number of industries. Think back, 1988. Think of the best leading high-tech industries of Germany. This happened to them. How many disappeared? How many still exist but are gutted? Think of the German banks in 1988, even into late 1989. Including Deutsche Bank, which were functioning real banks with real capabilities, real powers, and real policies. What happened? They're gone. They're shells controlled by wild-eyed speculators and young people who don't even know what money is. Look in the United States, a similar kind of process. Look at the destruction of the healthcare system. In each of these countries, notably compare Germany and the United States, which are quite comparable. Same thing. Destruction. Look at education. Is there going to be a next generation of Germans? What's coming out of the school systems of Germany today? What's happening to that generation? Are they going to be capable of handling the country? Enraged people? Is this country going to survive? So over the period since 1964-66, there was an overall change from a system which, with all its imperfections, worked. There was still net progress. And the problem was to remove the problems within a system which had net progress. From that point on, we've gone to a system overall globally of degeneration, decadence. We're now at the point that the world as presently organized, with its present population, is not capable of continuing to exist with the present trends. The system is collapsing. It's disintegrating. We've also had, at the same time, a disintegration morally and intellectually of the generations and institutions who have participated in this degeneration. We have a moral and intellectual degeneration of the populations themselves. People born after 1945, who were educated between 1945 and 1965, for example, in the United States, are morally inferior to the preceding generation. Morally and intellectually inferior to the preceding generation. The generation, their children, the children of those born in the late 1960s and on, their intellectual and moral capability is inferior, the so-called Generation X's, inferior to those of their parents. Their capability of living is less. They're not capable of the kind of productive employment that their parents' generation was capable of. They don't even know it exists anymore. People think in terms of money. Now let me get to the thing I said I was going to get to. The characteristic insanity in all of this is money. Money and pleasure. Money and pleasure. These are the markers of moral degeneration. The reality is that money is not in itself intrinsically important. Look, a government can cancel money. Money is about to cancel itself in a number of parts of the world. It canceled itself in Germany in 1923. And that can happen again. You don't have to dive into the euro to kill a Deutschmark. It could kill itself under present conditions. So money can evaporate. Banks can evaporate. Financial accounts can evaporate. So therefore, the competent person, especially the politician, does not think in terms of money or finances. They think of money and finances as instruments of government, not as the authority over government, but as the instruments of government. Any sovereign nation state has the intrinsic moral authority to create a currency. And only a sovereign nation state has that moral authority. A state has the moral authority to eliminate a currency, to cancel it. Because the function of a currency is to enable society to function. So a currency is created to enable society to function. Now, what is the function that society must perform? What is the economic function society must perform? Well, the essential thing is society must develop mankind's relationship to nature. Such things as producing food, for example. Transforming the desert into a habitable area in which food can be grown. Infrastructure to enable us to use land areas so people can feed themselves. The development of technologies, the development of industries, the development of mineral technology. All of these kinds of things which are necessary to do what? To increase man's power over nature. In what sense? By what standards? Well, per capita power. Take, for example, life expectancy. Take child mortality rates. Decrease child mortality rates, number one. Increase life expectancy. Prevent crippling diseases or minimize them. Recovery from diseases. A population, for example, which has a life expectancy of about 40 years of age cannot be a modern society. How can you educate a child for 25 years of life to become a professional person if the average member of society doesn't live beyond the age of 40? How are the children going to be maintained? So therefore, increasing life expectancy, decreasing child mortality, because that's an investment. Every child is an investment. It's an investment of the parents in creating the child. It's an investment in raising the child. It represents, in a sense, a sacrifice. It represents a cost, a real human cost, to produce that child and educate it. If the child dies, society has a loss. A loss of a potentially valuable individual which it took cost to produce. That's why the great tragedy is the death of children. The life that could have been, which was cost so much to create, on which so much hope was bestowed, taken away. So this is the thing. How do we do this? Well, we do this in two general ways. First of all, we make discoveries of scientific principle by which mankind's intellectual power over nature is increased. This is expressed in things like technology or the ability to control forces of nature. It's also expressed in culture in a general way, because mankind is a creature of ideas, which no animal is. No animal has ideas. They have impulses. They can be happy or unhappy, but they don't have ideas. Every dog does what a dog does before it. I mean, a dog is a dog is a dog is a dog. And sometimes we say a politician is a politician is a politician is a politician. But human beings are faced with challenges, make discoveries of principle, are able to prove these discoveries experimentally. They pass on the transmission of this discovery to someone else to reenact it. These discoveries are then shared within society. Society is able to cooperate around these discoveries for joint action for common purposes and to adopt purposes which coincide with these discoveries. But also, to do this, you must have a certain kind of social relationship, a social relationship which is based on ideas, not words, not so-called information. Because the most important thing about a human being is they are a human being, not a dog, not a cat, not a mouse, not a worm. Some politicians may qualify as worms, but that's a different story. The essential thing about a human being is the ability to transmit those kinds of things which correspond to humanity rather than bestiality. Those transmissions are ideas. Ideas is typified by scientific discoveries. And the use of great art, like classical art, is a way of enabling a society to understand itself. A great classical tragedy. What is it? A society is doomed. Well, many societies have been doomed. Practically every society that ever existed has been doomed. It's collapsed. Why did it collapse? Isn't that an important question? Here you are, you're investing in trying to build a society. And all these societies, people say, well, all these societies before you collapsed. What do you worry so much about? They ours will collapse too. They all collapse, you know, they all collapse. It's like the new car you bought yesterday. It's going to collapse tomorrow. It's this newfangled type of, you know, stimulate demand. Well, what do you learn from tragedy? In a classical tragedy, like the classical Greek tragedies, what's presented to you, contrary to what's taught in some schools about tragedy, is not the flaw of the individual personality, not a character flaw. What is demonstrated to you is, as in the case of Hamlet, the famous Shakespeare Hamlet. Hamlet was not a person of flawed moral character. He was a person who represented, like most of the other characters in the play, the society which had doomed itself. And every case of classical tragedy presents a case, a historically specific case or an idealized case of a society which doomed itself. And it selected leaders whose opinions were consistent with the flaw in the character of the society. And Hamlet was just that. Hamlet was consistent. Remember the last act, the last scene in Hamlet. You have Hamlet's corpse is being carried off stage. And you have Fortinbras, this crazy Norwegian, is going out. They just have about destroyed Denmark and about to destroy the rest of the world with all these crazy killings. And all throughout the entire drama, remember the whole sledded poleaxe on the ice in Hamlet, all this killing is being done. The killing, murder, so forth. A real disgusting kind of society. Portrayed by Shakespeare in great detail and great refinement. And then you have the final scene with Horatio and Fortinbras. And Fortinbras is a charge, we're going to do it again! And Horatio, in an aside to the audience, says, let us reenact these events while they're fresh in mind before more mischance by plots occur. That was change the society.
You've been listening to EIR Talks, presenting excerpts from Lyndon LaRouche's August 18th speech in Oberwesel, Germany. To replay this program or to read the full transcript of the conference, visit our website at larouchepub.com. That's www.larouchepub.com. EIR Talks will return in a moment with closing announcements.